Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Two families, the Bushes and the Clintons, have held the White House now for nearly a generation. And our guests for this hour of the show says that that is no accident. We're talking with John Harris. He is the national political editor of The Washington Post, and he is the along with Mark Halperin, who is political director of ABC News, co-author of a recently published book that takes a look at American politics and looks ahead to the next presidential contest. The book is The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. It's published by Random House. And in the book, the authors argue that the reason these two families have dominated American politics in recent years is that over some years in the business, they've learned what works. And in part, they've learned that by studying each other's successes and failures. This morning, we'll talk a bit about the presidential race of 2008, also about why it is that American politics has turned so bitter and destructive. And as we talk with John Harris, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief, please. That helps us keep the program moving, and it gives a chance for as many different people as possible to get in on the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can certainly give us a call. And Mr. Harris, hello.
Yeah, David, good morning. I was told by your producer a minute ago that my audio sounded not great.
Well,
I've got somebody here at this end is going to correct that if we still need it.
It actually sounds like either you're not in front of the microphone or the microphone you're in front of is not turned on, because it sounds like I'm hearing you from a long way away.
I sent a message to somebody to correct that. I'm sorry, if I was any closer to the mic, I'd be practically having a romantic relationship.
I see. Well, all right.
Let's see if we can remedy
that. I tell you what, maybe the thing to do would be to just get you on a conventional phone, and we can do it that way. Doesn't sound quite as nice as this, but given the circumstances, maybe that'd be better. Because I just want to make sure that people who are listening can hear you clearly, and otherwise I'm afraid people will say, we'll find something else to do for this hour. So why don't we do that? Hang on there. We'll get you set up, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. right. I think now that we're set up on the telephone, we'll do it the old-fashioned way here with our guest, John Harris. Mr. Harris?
Hey, I'm sorry. We are using a phone line, but hopefully this will work fine.
Hey, that's okay. Well, it sounds really good, and, you know, we talk to a lot of people this way, so no problem at all.
Great.
Thanks very much for being with us. One of the things that you and your co-author explain here is that the two families, the two sides, the Clintons, the Bushes, have employed very different political strategies. And if you look at their playbooks and look at the bullet points of what's important, well, the two sides, the list will look different. And on the Clinton side, the man who has been the chief strategist there has been Mr. Clinton, Bill Clinton himself. On the Bush side, the person who's been the chief strategist is Karl Rove. So maybe just to start, you could, and we can talk about some of these things and how they work in reality, and also about the media environment in which they have to operate. But if I said, okay, give me the thumbnail sketch of the Clinton, the basics of the Clinton strategy, what would that be?
Well, first off, there's a number of things that that aren't necessarily different. Mm-hmm. The Clintons and the Roves have watched each other intently, and when they see things that that the other side is doing, excuse me, the Clintons and the Bushes have watched each other intently, and when they see things that the other side is doing, they're more than happy to borrow those and incorporate those in their own strategy. But you're quite right. At the fundamental level, there are two different brands of politics, and in the way to win, my co-author Mark Halpern and I describe these as Clinton politics and Bush politics. The chief sponsor, as you say, of Clinton politics is Bill Clinton himself, and he would almost certainly be Hillary Clinton's chief strategist if she runs in 2008. Karl Rove is the strategic mastermind behind Bush politics. Just as an aside, I should say we're not arguing in this book that that President Bush is Rove's puppet. Far from it. But really, Bush does turn to him for a strategic understanding of presidential elections. Mm-hmm. Clinton politics is a politics that says, look, Americans fundamentally want to be united. People don't like the angry, divisive nature of our politics, and they'd like a politics that's more unifying. So the chief challenge of a political figure is to transcend all these differences, all these bickering. Now, doing that sometimes means rounding the edges on difficult issues. It's about blurring some of the ideological distinctions. Clinton would do that because he felt like fundamentally, as long as he can, as a candidate and as a president, have a high approval rating, he's going to be insulated from this very divisive, destructive politics that we have. Now, Bush politics says it argues really the opposite. It says, look, the reason politics is angry and divisive is, in fact, the electorate on important issues is, in fact, very narrowly divided. The challenge is not to be a unifying figure, but it's to clarify these differences and make sure you're on the right side of that line. So one politics is the politics of growing the center outward. The other politics is the politics of the base, making sure that you're on the winning side of base politics.
Hmm. I suppose that some people would look at the two basic strategies and say something like, well, you know, that's really interesting that there have been times at which both strategies have worked. So if you would look at the times that Mr. Clinton was elected and reelected, you would have to say, well, you know, it looks like maybe that's right. Maybe, in fact, Americans fundamentally don't want to be divided, and they appreciate someone who is trying to find some middle way. Then, though, you take a look at the fact that Mr. Bush was elected and reelected, and then you might have to scratch your head and say, well, gosh, maybe it's maybe that's not right. Maybe,
yeah,
in fact,
well, if you look at the Bush,
does it matter about, you know, is it something about the atmosphere that dictates which strategy works when?
Yeah, well, your question is very shrewd because, in fact, we do over this past generation see examples of both political strategies working effectively. Now, interestingly, in 2000, George W. Bush basically ran on a version of Clinton politics, and I think a lot of us in the media were somewhat misled by that. It's not his fault. It's our own fault for not reporting this and clarifying it more aggressively. But we thought, and I certainly would put myself in this category, that we thought that George W. Bush was running as a conservative version of a centrist politician, a kind of a Republican version of Clinton politics. And I think, in fact, that does accurately describe his election strategy in 2000, portraying himself as a compassionate conservative. We quickly learned once he got in office that running a slightly more conservative version of Clinton's presidency was far from his ambition and far from Dick Cheney's ambition. They actually had authentic, genuinely conservative ideas on which they wanted to govern. In some cases, people would say they have radically conservative ideas. Even before 9/11, this was the case. After 9/11, it was emphatically the case. And we've seen in the past two elections a version of what we call Bush politics, again, directed by Karl Rove, that has worked to Republicans' advantage by clarifying these differences, by trying to make the opposition Democrats look like unacceptable alternatives to a majority of the country, really sharpening the dividing lines, essentially using polarization as an ally in American politics. Now, that worked in 2002, worked in 2004. Right now we're on the brink of an election just 3 weeks away from today, in fact. It's not clear that that strategy can work. Just an interesting point, though, that Rove's strategic view is having influence not just in the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party. Take what Ned Lamont did in Connecticut in defeating a sitting senator in the, Joe Lieberman in that Democratic primary in August. Classic Rove techniques. He didn't try to blur differences. He clarified and sharpened them. He used technology creatively to increase the size of the turnout of his ideological base and showed the power of that.
Although I think to a lot of people would say in that particular race, to their surprise, it looks as if maybe Mr. Lieberman can actually be reelected as an independent.
Well, right. And you've got this, and I'd say in Connecticut it's actually a little sort of laboratory dish that we have of the two brands of politics that are going to be in competition in 2008. Joe Lieberman, throughout his career, has practiced a version of what we would call Clinton politics, the politics of the center, seeks to play down partisan divisions, seeks to, in most cases, play down ideological divisions. And it does look, you know, like at the moment he's on a trajectory to win that race. And so if Lamont's victory was a big triumph, his primary victory was a big triumph for base politics, if Lieberman comes back and wins that as an independent, I think you'd have to say that's an even bigger triumph for centrist politics.
Given the fact that on the Democrat side in 2000, they had a strategy that had worked for them twice, and they had they had Mr. Clinton himself that they could draw on for his advice and his expertise, why was not Al Gore more successful as a candidate?
Well, this is we could spend the rest of the hour talking about this, and I'm sure we probably even arguing about it with some of your callers. And I know we don't want to do that, but the I wrote a book before this one on Bill Clinton's presidency called The Survivor, Bill Clinton in the White House, and discussed this at some length. Clinton was hugely frustrated in 2000 that Al Gore would not run unapologetically on the Clinton administration record. Al Gore himself thought that record had been tarnished by the Lewinsky scandal and thought that Clinton fatigue had set in with independent-minded voters, and particularly in some of the most important states like Ohio. So he really did distance himself. Now, people are already probably lining up to say, yes, but Al Gore did win the popular vote, and a lot of people believe strongly, and I think understandably, that if votes had been fairly counted in Florida, he would have been president. But the fact is, given the general climate of the country at a time of peace and prosperity, a more agile campaign by Al Gore in 2000, I think, would have won that election for him and put it outside the reach of the Supreme Court. One person who intensely believes that is Bill Clinton himself. We talked to him for this latest book in his for a good long time, a couple-hour conversation up in his living room in Chappaqua, New York, about this subject, what he's learned over the course of his career about politics, about the way media has changed the political game. You know, even 6 years after the fact, his frustration with Gore is evident, to some degree, his frustration with John Kerry. He felt both those were winnable races, and it was a failure of political strategy on the Democratic side that kept the White House from going into Democratic hands.
Well, I suppose that even, and maybe this was just in the aftermath of 2000, I think that there were probably a lot of people that agreed that the Democrats really made a mistake in not taking advantage of Mr. Clinton, who was one of their strongest potential advisors and, in fact, strongest pitch men. And the fact that they did sideline him, they said, we're not really sure we want to associate with him. And I think probably a lot of Democrats would say that really was a mistake.
Well, Bill Clinton said something interesting to us when we spoke with him a few months back. I guess it was in early April we had that conversation with him. And he said, look, the thing you need to know about politics is it's like any great contest. All great contests are head games. There's a real psychological dimension to them. And he didn't name names in this, but it was clear from the context of the conversation he was talking about, above all, Al Gore, I think to a lesser degree, but also talking about John Kerry. They allowed the intensity of the competition to get inside their head and to paralyze them from clear thinking. I think there's no question, and in The Way to Win, we do go back and dissect both campaigns, Kerry's and Gore's. It's kind of a case study in you know, to be blunt about it, the way to lose. In both cases, the candidates were psychologically rattled by the attacks of the other side. And Clinton very much believes that's what kept Gore from running on his record in 2000. And with respect to Kerry, he believes that Kerry really did not respond effectively to the attacks of the Swift Boat veterans, who did such damage to him in the summer of 2004. And, of course, that carried over into the through the fall campaign. And really, although it was a close race, I think probably was the most decisive factor in Kerry's defeat.
Well, then I think that when you look at that section, and there are these major sections in the book that look at what are the key points of the Clinton strategy and the key points of the Bush, Roe Bush Republican strategy. And I think that on the Democrat side, on the Clinton side, it's very clear that Mr. Clinton believes that you have to take your critics head on, and you don't let a moment pass without, if somebody attacks you, if someone says something that's not right, you've got to step up immediately and respond. And that you've got to be equally, I think he would probably say, you've got to be equally tough with leadership of your own party. And he seems, you know, it seems like one of his bottom lines is, no matter what it is you're talking about, never take no for an answer.
Well, that's a good way of putting it. And there's two questions here. He does believe that when you're a politician and you're attacked, from the vantage point of the typical voter, and this is how he described it to us, is that, look, you know, most people, they're out there, they're trying to make a living, they're living their lives. They're paying attention less to the attack than how are you going to respond to the attack. Is this person strong? Is this person willing to push back when he's pushed? He really believes that's important, and he doesn't think that either Gore or Kerry did so aggressively. You'll recall just a few weeks ago when he lost his cool with an interview with Fox News, and I think he did genuinely get angry. But he was also making a point there that look, that's what you need to do. If you're there, he believes the whole media environment now, in terms of the proliferation of new media, is stacked towards conservatives, and he thinks that Democrats need to be much more aggressive in pushing back against that. Don't let an attack lie. If somebody gets in your face, you get back in their face. That's one thing. Now, the other thing is, and this is not just a matter of being partisan, he would say, because another thing that effective politicians do, and this is something that George W. Bush has in common with Bill Clinton, is they think very clearly about the weaknesses of their own party. It's just human nature to think about the weaknesses of the other party and to not dwell on your own weaknesses. Clinton believes that the Democratic Party needs to be honest with itself about voters that it's not winning, culturally naturally conservative voters, a lot of evangelical Christians, he believes could be Democratic voters if the party would do a better job speaking to them. In the book, we describe the term we use is these trade secrets. What are the trade secrets of that separate winners from losers? One of the trade secrets is they run toward their weaknesses, not against it, not away from them.
We have a caller here to bring in the conversation.
Sure.
Why don't we do that? And let me again introduce our guest. We're almost at the midpoint here already. We're talking with John Harris. He's the national political editor of The Washington Post. He is the co-author, along with Mark Halperin, who is political director of ABC News. They're co-authors of the book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. It's published by Random House. And it's a book, really, it's a book about political strategy and about what it takes to win elections. Not so much focused on what it is that either Bill Clinton or George Bush did after they were elected. It's not so much about governing, although they do also say that obviously you can't completely separate those two things. But mostly what this is about is political strategy at the presidential level and about what it is that has worked for the two sides and about what the two sides have learned from looking at the other and finding out, looking at what has worked for their political opponents. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Urbana where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello. It seems to me you're simplifying this a bit too much. The two schools you describe, I would go along with. I wouldn't say that Karl Rove invented the divide and slander system. It seems to me it goes directly back to the Germans in the 1930s, where Adolf Hitler ran against Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, and non-Aryans. Bush and Rove are running against liberals, homosexuals, and what they call fundamentalist Islamist, which is fuzzy enough that it seems to include all Mohammedans, or all Muslims, pardon me. They also use the fascist technique of the big lie. It perhaps is impossible to prove that Karl Rove invented the Swift Boat campaign, or the claim that Al Gore said he had invented the Internet, which he never said, but certainly they made use of these. And it seems to me this kind of campaigning is so corrosive that it threatens to destroy the very foundations of a democratic republic.
Well, Mr. Harris, you want to talk about that?
I can respond to some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't accept the analogy between the Republican techniques, as tough as they are, and the and liking them to the techniques of Hitler's Germany. And I would certainly think the caller makes an interesting point that the politics of polarization and the politics of trying to make your opponent an unacceptable alternative, which really has been the essence of certainly the Republican strategy. I'd say increasingly it's an attractive strategy for a lot of Democrats who have been terribly frustrated by the success, what they see as the success of these political tactics.
Precisely, and also, why I say it's corrosive.
I beg your pardon?
Precisely why I say it's corrosive.
Yes, and there's the part that I really can agree with. In this book, Mark Halperin and I are describing the world as it is in our judgment. We are not describing the world as it should be. I do agree with you that a politics that tries to emphasize divisions in which all the incentives in politics and in media culture are toward extremist language. They're in favor of attack and increasingly providing incentives against bridging divides and being solution-oriented. I do think that's had a corrosive effect on our politics. I do think there's some distinctive aspects to the polarization that is afflicting American politics right now. Again, I want to emphasize, polarization is not new. Every generation, virtually, of American history has gone through polarized periods. What I think is distinctive about this era is the way that changes in media culture and changes in corresponding changes in political culture have created these incentives. You've got people profiting from polarization and deliberately exploiting it, to some degree deliberately marketing polarization for their own self-interested reasons. I don't think that's a good way to practice politics in a democracy, but I think increasingly that is what we have.
Well, I would suggest that it is necessary for perhaps not objective reporting, but commentary, to be somewhat judgmental. And it has been the tendency to simply state, this is the way it is on one side, this is what the other fellow says, and not to be at all critical of what is being said.
Well, there's some things there that I can go along with and some implications of what you say that I'm going to resist. This is one of the most sort of common criticisms that people in my business, you know, the so-called old media. I work for the Washington Post. I help guide our political coverage here. My co-author, Mark Halperin, does the same at ABC News. Used to be that if we were getting an angry letter from somebody that started out, USOBs almost invariably came from somebody on the right that was accusing us of liberal bias. These days, I'm much more likely to get a letter that starts out USOBs or worse. It'll probably be an email rather than a letter from somebody on the liberal side who thinks that journalistic conventions of objectivity, of fairness, of sort of laying out both sides, in fact, have been inhibiting, that they prevent us from adequately illuminating the truth, and they prevent us from doing our journalistic duty to challenge power and to more systematically expose the Bush administration. Here's what I would say about that. I do think that those journalistic conventions sometimes can be inhibiting. They can get in the way of simply stating the truth as best we can ascertain it in very plain, simple language. And I do think that both sides, but in particular the conservatives, have used what they know is widespread mistrust of the mainstream media for political advantage. I think the remedy to that is to vindicate our own standards and try to live up to them by being honest truth tellers and by stating the truth as clearly as we can ascertain it in very plain terms. I do not think that the response is for old media to become like so much of the new media is, which is basically presenting news as a form of opinion. This new media environment that's grown up and proliferated over the past decades, to my mind, tends to see almost every news story not as a neutral and agreed-upon fact, but as either a weapon or a shield in this great ideological war. And there's strong pressures on us from both sides to join in that, to sort of throw the old standards and the old journalistic principles by the wayside, and itself and participate equally in that shouting match. And I just think, given all the other problems that people that our business, old media faces, with an economic model that doesn't work as well as it has in the past, I just think that would be the worst thing. There has to be a common space in politics where people can agree on some basic facts, even if they disagree about the implications of those. And so I really would resist those who say that we need to be more vocal, more opinionated as a way of somehow illuminating some higher truth.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I've got somebody I want to get to. Just very quickly, it's from my reading of the book, it sounds as if you and your co-author, your criticism of the old media is that's already happened. That is, with the need to respond to the challenge of new media, and in the extremely difficult economic conditions that the old media are having to deal with, that in the, that you already have changed the way you do things, and that's that has that contributes to the proliferation of junk news, essentially, not just in new media, but sometimes in old media.
Yes, I think that's a fair reading of our book, and I really appreciate your obviously giving it such a careful read because you have discerned our argument. We call this new environment in which the incentives in politics and in media for extremism, for frivolity, for purience, and away from a serious substantive discussion, we call that the freak show. Freak show values, to our mind, have infected both new media, the blogs, the ideologically driven cable networks, and the rest. They've infected new media, but they've also lamentably infected old media. Now, I'm not just trying to keep my job. I do think that there's a place like the Washington Post has laudably resisted this trend. I could point to other news organizations that have done the same, but I do not think that we have, as I said earlier, I do not think that we've lived up to and vindicated our own best standards. And this is a book about political strategy. It's not a media book, but we do concentrate a lot on media because this environment, the freak show environment, is the pervasive reality that somebody running for president now has to reckon with. It was in 2000. It was again in 2004. Almost certainly will be in 2008.
And the only, just again, to draw the liner to this, your argument is that the only way that's really going to stop, the only way that Americans will stop being the freak show, is if news consumers decide they're tired of it. They're not going to respond. They're not going to watch it. They're not going to listen. It's unlikely that people who are running for office, if they find that strategy seems to work, they're not going to give it up. The only reason, the only thing that's going to change things is if people decide they just aren't going to go with it anymore. They aren't going to watch it. They aren't going to read it. They aren't going to buy it.
We are, again, we are describing not the world that we wish we were inhabiting, but the world that we are inhabiting when it comes to politics. Yeah. That is true. It would be nice if media executives themselves would say, look, we are going to turn away from this freak show, and we're going to do our best to battle it and to return to that earlier era, which was imperfect, but it was better than our own, when the media, both old and new, could serve as a referee on politics and help elevate the discussion rather than drag it down. But as a practical matter, I don't see that happening. I don't see people in politics, even though there are a great many who lament what's happened to the way campaigns are run, who lament how sort of angry and divisive and superficial the debate has become. If they would themselves turn away from it, I think it's not likely to happen because there's powerful incentives for publicity, for money, for influence to respond to the freak show and to help perpetrate it. So ultimately, it's going to be up to people themselves to say, look, you know, this is just not what we want, and to not reward it with votes, not reward it with an audience.
We have about 15 minutes left. The lines are full. Callers will help us by being brief. John
Sure.
Harris is our guest. He's national political editor at The Washington Post, is the co-author, along with Mark Halperin, who is political director of ABC News. They're the co-authors of the book The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. It's published by Random House. Next caller is on cell phone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I think your program is very good. I was always curious about media when they took the pro and con people with an issue. They usually pick people that are obviously on the very ends of the issue. And I think it would be a very common sense approach then is to poll the whole group of experts to see where they stand and what their solutions would be to a problem rather than centering on the two right and left approaches to a problem. And to me, maybe we could get away from these terms of, well, he's a liberal or he's a conservative and just the labels rather than the positions of where we want to go with these things, because I think it's amazing how they've taken the word liberal and it's almost turned it into a very distasteful term, whereas somebody liberal in a classical sense was always somebody who was somewhat open-minded, and now it's like someone who is is labeled as a somebody who doesn't have an open mind. But the only thing I seem to think that if we look back and historically in politics is the fact that we, even back during Jefferson's time, the media has been quite flamboyant about attacking, so I don't think we're going to get rid of this. And the only time I think change really, really occurs is when we have a crisis and there's a public opinion feels that we need to do something to solve this crisis rather than prevent this crisis. So I'd like to hear your opinions. Thank you.
All right. You can comment on any and all of that you want.
Sure. Well, there's a bunch in there that I am actually quite sympathetic toward. Again, I go back to that word I keep using here, which is incentives. He raises the point, why can't we have more kind of elimination of lots of different points of view in the center, as opposed to finding the most flamboyant extreme people? You know, let's put Ann Coulter against Michael Moore and call that the debate, even though neither of those would really resonate with most people. The reason they do that is because, there are powerful incentives in the media for presenting issues that way. And I'd say some of those same incentives exist in the political world for framing issues that way. The historical point is right. We've gone through periods of this in the past. Right now it's fueled by some things that are indeed historically new, including the rise of technologies, which mean that the world of media and people who are in it is much, much larger than it's ever been in the past. That's diminished the so-called old media, my line of work, from a lot of its relative power has been diminished, and so forth. Therefore, the ability to be a referee and something of a filter in the news. Now, as far as a crisis, I have to say that these incentives may be so powerful that they kind of ride through any crisis. A lot of people thought 9/11 would fundamentally alter the character and content of our politics, and it really didn't. The divisions that first evidenced themselves in the Clinton years have stayed very much alive. If anything, they've even accelerated in the Bush years, as a lot of the issues themselves have become authentically, powerfully divisive, most of all the Iraq War. So there's serious issues that we're debating now, but we're often debating them in what I would call a freak show style that's based on more on personal attack than genuine illumination of different points of view.
Now let's talk with someone here in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Here's three names I'm looking at for 2008.
Sure.
For the Republicans, John McCain, and two Democratic names, our own Barack Obama and Elliot Spitzer in New York, should he be elected governor. I'd like to hear your comments on all three of them. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd be delighted. In fact, I'm actually welcome the call, which is a good political junkies call. We've been, Dave, sort of discussing some pretty serious themes in the book, and the book is serious, but it's also meant as a kind of a romp through modern politics. Both Mark and I are political junkies ourselves, and the book is intended to be fun and even in places funny. John McCain is, by virtue of his experience, including the experience of losing in 2000, clearly starts the 2008 race in the most commanding position on the Republican side. He may well be the most commanding of any side, of anybody on either side. Hillary Clinton also has a lot of advantages. She's far more electable than I think most people realize, in part by virtue of the fact that she has been watching and adapting through both the Clinton presidency and the Bush presidency. These are two powerful figures that really loom far over most of their competition at this point. Both of them clearly will face opposition, and somebody will emerge as the alternative. Barack Obama, I've been taking him until pretty recently at his word that he wasn't going to run for president in 2008. I'm not sure that's the case anymore. He's clearly enjoying the attention he's getting, and he's clearly intends to use it to raise his own profile even further. And that may well mean a run for president on the, I think, somewhat of the theory of, look, let's try it and see what happens. There's nothing to lose, and he'd just be positioned next time if it doesn't work out, or possibly for a vice presidential pick. It does seem to me he's got the bug of some kind. Elliot Spitzer, that would surprise me. He may well become a prominent figure in national life when he is elected in New York. He has minimal opposition. He's almost certainly going to be the next governor of New York. I don't see him stepping on the 2008 stage.
We clearly, if you look at the example of Bill Clinton and when he ran the first time around, you see that a candidate can come not exactly out of nowhere, but can come from being somebody who nobody is thinking about to suddenly being there right at the front of the pack.
Well, that's certainly the perception from a distance, that, you know, Clinton was not well known to most Americans, came from a small state. All of that is true. But it's equally true, and I think there's an important lesson there, that among an elite circle, in the book we recall this phrase that Sidney Blumenthal, a journalist who later went on to work for Clinton, first used in 1992. He called it the conversation. The conversation is these discussions that go on. They aren't strictly about politics in the narrow sense. They're about politics in the larger sense, and they're also about policy and ideas. Both Bill and Hillary Clinton had been in that national conversation with policy experts, with intellectuals, with important people on the political scene at the state level for years and years before he ever ran for president in 1992. You know, somewhat surprisingly, Karl Rove has been in the conservative equivalent of the conversation for at least a decade before George W. Bush ever ran. In our experience, the politicians who wake up in an odd-numbered year and say, you know, next year I'm going to run for president, without having been in that conversation, without having thought seriously about what their ideas are, and importantly, how to marry their ideas to a political strategy, they tend not to go very far. It may be different in 2008, but as for an example of what I'm talking about, I'd say, look, maybe at John Edwards in 2004. Yes, he succeeded on getting on the ticket, but his actual presidential campaign often was hobbled by the fact that there were a lot of things that he had not thought through, and there was a certain tinniness or hollowness there that I think, you know, at critical moments during the campaign did shine through.
I think there are some people who think that maybe Al Gore might run again.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Again, as long as we're just having a political junkies bull session, I've often believed that, you know, he's going to look at the opportunities, and there's a huge opportunity right now on the liberal side of the Democratic Party. A lot of people there are not that enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton, either because they think she can't win or they think she's been opportunistic on the Iraq War, that are really looking for someone to come out much more aggressively and more in a much more forthright fashion, stand in opposition to Iraq, in opposition to what the Bush administration has done over the past several years. And I really do think that Gore, that opportunity exists for Gore, and I've always had a hunch that he might respond to the opportunity.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Belgium next, nearby community, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I hope I'm not going to ask questions that's been previously asked, but earlier you mentioned the Swift Boat people who did the attack ad on Senator Kerry. And I, for the life of me, I cannot understand why they won when the candidate they're supporting really took the rich college boy way out of the Vietnam situation, where Mr. Kerry took the position that, well, he'll go and fight, or he'll go and at least do his service, whichever that was. And he never stood up to that. I just can't understand how that policy won. Could you explain that? Thank you very much.
I think on the Democratic side, and I think this is certainly true on the part of Kerry himself, there was a belief that it was so self-evidently a false charge or an implausible charge when you compare Kerry's record of serving in Vietnam against the Bush-Cheney personal history, that they thought it was sort of transparently absurd. And in that, they underestimated the power of freak show politics in which an ideologically charged group can level an attack, and it will echo through the media and into the larger political arena, and can be devastatingly effective. And so not responding is simply not an option. You know, Clinton, in his interview with us, said something interesting. He said, for Democrats of my generation, he's talking, you know, Clinton is 60 and he's a little bit younger than Kerry, but not much. He said, we grew up looking at the media as essentially an ally for our politics. The press led the way on Watergate, on Vietnam, on civil rights. And Clinton believed that the media would, when he first came into politics, somewhat naively believed that the media would insulate him from attacks. He says, you know, Democrats have to get over that. There's no such thing as a media referee anymore. I think Kerry may, I lament that, you know, just in terms of my own views, but I think Kerry made that mistake that Bill Clinton described of thinking that an unfair attack would be, that other people could respond for him.
Let's go to another caller. Line three, this is Champagne. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question is kind of follows on to that. It seems that during the Bush administration, there's been much more, I would call it, censorship of news or distortion of news. One example, just a couple of weekends ago, there was a huge amount of bombing and many deaths in Iraq. And I heard it first on BBC. Thanks to WILL, we get it. And even that evening on the Lara News Hour, it was completely ignored, not even mentioned in up front where he gives tiny tidbits of the news. Another example is the way Bush manipulates the press, seemingly to me more so than previous presidents. And recently a woman named Susan Golden or something like that resigned his administration because she was in cahoots with Abramoff and making appointments for Karl Rove into Abramoff's office, and all the stuff hit the fan, and she promptly resigned, and that was soft-pedaled, and even on Monday.
Well, let me take a crack at that, because we don't have much time.
Yeah, that,
in general,
yeah, that's right.
You're
Reuters and BBC preempt.
Yeah.
Well, let me, I think I get where you're coming from. You know, the Susan Ralston is that woman's name. That was a front-page story in the Washington Post. I know what you mean. There are times that you know, deaths in Iraq have become, unfortunately, so routine that things that would have been big stories a couple of years ago sometimes are only modest stories in the U.S. media. Almost always when you're trying to describe media behavior, you can look for a more plausible explanation than the sort of conspiracy theory. I understand where you're coming from. Incidentally, your mention of Champagne reminds me. I was going to say I had spent many years as a youth just up the road in Paxton, Illinois, where my mother and grandparents are from.
We're pretty much at the point where we're going to have to stop. Just maybe one thing real quick. It looks not like now there is a chance, I'm not sure how good a chance, but a chance that the Republicans might lose their majorities in Congress. And certainly the president has been facing some very difficult times. People are unhappy about the administration, what it's done and hasn't done. His approval ratings are quite low. If the control of Congress should change, what does that mean for Karl Rove and for the strategy that he has advanced and to date has worked?
Well, to date it has worked, and I believe that if Democrats take power in 3 weeks in the 2006 election, it means that with respect to Bush and Rove himself, that strategy has run out its rope, that it may have worked as a political strategy through several years, but no political strategy is strong enough to overcome policy failure. And I do think that that electoral verdict would be a clear statement that Americans have decided that the Bush administration's policies, and particularly in Iraq, have failed, and they are voting for change. Now, that result does not mean, as we discussed, that the Rove strategic model is over. In fact, I think we're going to see presidential candidates in 2008 in both parties, just as we're seeing in the midterm elections, candidates in both parties using either a Rove-driven Bush politics or a Clinton-driven Clinton politics. So Rove's strategic model, I think, is very much going to be with us for the next several years, even if the presidency he worked for is going to be hobbled and really rebuked by voters on November 7th.
All right. Well, there we'll leave it. There's much more about politics and media and how the two come together in the book, The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. It is published by Random House, co-authored by our guest, John Harris. He's the national political editor at The Washington Post, and also Mark Halperin. He's the political director of ABC News. And Mr. Harris, thanks very much.
Thank you. Great fun to talk with you.